Eugene Mazo explains why lack of quorum is such a problem.
If my opponent is violating the law and somehow I can complain to the FEC, and the FEC can bring an enforcement action. But that can only happen if there is a quorum of four commissioners.
Trump quickly nominated Alan Dickerson, the legal director of the pro-Citizens United Free Speech Institute, and Mississippi lawmakers voted yesterday to remove the Confederate emblem, the last in the country to use it, from their state flag. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
FM KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
We have a fully packed show. Remember that you can get a whole lot more stuff than I can talk about. And even on my blog, there's a whole lot more stuff you can link to. So thinkwingradio.com, just go to the blog tab and find the most recent post usually, and that's this show. I'm on Twitter at thinkwingradio. I'm on Facebook at thinkwingradio. And I'm on KPFT. So you see, it all works. And Andrew, you have your thing.
I do. I am at DominateEYE on Twitter and DominateEYE.tumblr.com.
Okay, so first of all, the election stuff. There is a runoff July 14th. I believe that's a Saturday. Mail-in ballots have already gone out. I have sent mine in. So if you haven't gotten yours, you should inquire. And remember, these kinds of elections don't generally have a high participation. So your vote matters more than usual. This is a primary runoff. There are a number of individuals and positions on the ballot. You just have to go to harrisvotes.com. Or if you're outside of Harris County, you can go to votetexas.gov. That's all on the website, so you don't worry. Okay. The general theme of the show today is the country is going through changes. You know, aside from like the COVID thing, as my wife has seen, she didn't grow up in the United States. She grew up in China. So history here is a little new to her. And I referred her to the 1960s. And it's like, wow, we're talking about the same stuff 50 years later. Yes, we are. But some of this is interesting, and just kind of follow along with me here as we go through the hour. First, I thought this was interesting. ABC13.com had a story that master bedrooms are now changed due to an overarching theme. As someone who was in a trade in home installation, this is kind of interesting to me because this debate came up after my time in the business. That the Houston Association of Realtors has made changes to its room descriptions on its property database, replacing the term master with primary. So a master bedroom is now a primary bedroom. A master bath is now a primary bath. That is the terminology that they'll use officially on the website. The quote in the story is that the MLS advisory group regularly reviews the terms and fields used in the MLS to make sure they're consistent with the current market environment. As an example, I'm just going to interject here, like East Downtown didn't sound sexy, whereas Edo, that sounds sexy.
Ah.
That's realtors. That's realtors. That's what they do. So the updates to primary bedroom and primary bath were among 9 requests for review that were submitted by members and considered at the most recent meetings, including an option to show whether the property has an electric vehicle charging station. So this is all part of evolution. It's not just social, racial. It's also technological, spatial, if you will. So that's kind of interesting. This is a sign of the evolving times. And then there's another story that's kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum from theroot.com. Talking loud and saying nothing. Unilever will strike fair and lovely from its branding, but will continue to sell skin lightening products. So heavily excerpted here. Spurred by increased attention to racism and social and racial justice, brands across all industries have scrambled to do the right thing. I'm surprised that the writer didn't put air quotes there, by black consumers. Among these companies is Unilever, which multinational conglomerate owns Dove, Palmolive, L'Oreal, and has made a lot of money hawking skin whitening products to consumers of color around the world. Now Unilever has vowed to strike the words fair and lovely from its skin lightening products. But the writer goes on, there's a catch. There are no plans to change the actual formulas of the products themselves, the company told BuzzFeed. The change is exclusively and literally in name only. So the article goes on, beauty standards throughout the world are pegged to skin color. In many non-white color countries in particular, they've internalized the idea that whiteness or proximity to it is part and parcel with being beautiful. Story goes on to name specific countries and areas. Sunny Jane, president of beauty and personal care at Unilever, addressed the company's culpability, the writer's word, in reinforcing toxic, dangerous ideas about beauty and whiteness, again, the writer's opinion. The focus on language elides, I love when you get words. The focus on language elides the actual material effects of fair and lovely products. BuzzFeed was told by Unilever that they don't use 2 of the most toxic skin lighteners, hydroquinone and bleach. Hydroquinone has been banned by some countries. But the president of beauty and personal care omits the stated promise of those products focused on products' ability to even skin tone and make it radiant without mentioning the whitening effects on the skin. So here, this person, Sunny Jane, is speaking in recognized beauty euphemisms. As the South China Morning Post reported, brands will label, quote, whitening products as, quote, lightening or brightening. Obviously, the writer of this particular article took a very, very dim view of Unilever. You can judge, I suppose, whether there's validity either way. Yes, skin lightening, whiteness, beauty. I mean, there is something to skin evening, especially as people with darker skin tones or as people age, you do get what are sometimes called sunspots or liver spots. You do get unevening in the skin tone. So if that matters to you, just like any kind of cosmetic procedure, there could be a cosmetically valid reason for that. Obviously, the story is focusing more on the racial aspects of it and the racialism of it. So, Andrew, I guess at this point I'm going to ask if you want to drop anything in there.
I do. So
you are so patient with me. It's really
These two stories that we're talking about, We've talked about one and now we're talking about the other, but they're kind of connected to me in that, they're obviously connected in that, companies are changing their policies in response to social change, or in response to, you know, cultural change. I mean, I want to preface everything I'm about to say by saying that I'm white and
I'm an old white guy. You're a young white guy.
Yes. And so, you know, there's plenty of analysis here that I can't make because I don't have the appropriate lived experience, I believe. So
it would be speculative at best.
Yes. And so with that in mind, I agree with basically the author's tone in the Unilever story, in that, you know, this is it's about saying and not doing. It really is trying to avoid any real concrete action while also looking like you are listening to people, which isn't a very nice thing to do, isn't a very genuine thing to do. And so I can absolutely understand why there are people who are upset over this. The Realtor like terms article. Now, I want to say that neither of these changes are something that I think shouldn't have happened. I think that both of these changes, especially the change in terminology in realty, because it there's been a push from Black realtors to change these terms. And
yeah, it was an unintentional subliminal meaning that because white people are a majority, we don't think about. It's kind of like, I'm Jewish, I think of Jewish things that non-Jews don't think about.
Sure. But, you know, because this was a change that was being pushed by Black realtors, you know,
For years, apparently.
For years, yeah. I'm very glad that they've, you know, gotten to victory, at least here in Houston, about this. But what I'm concerned...
Well, I want to insert here that the Houston area realtors cover a big territory. I mean, it goes into adjacent counties also. So this is a big chunk of Texas, both geographically and in terms of population.
Okay.
So well, it's influential.
Okay. Yeah, that's even better. But what worries me about this is the kind of the same worry I have about what Unilever has done is that this is going to be viewed by some members of that organization as being enough. You know, it's going to be sort of not necessary to take any more concrete action because language is important. Both Mike and I believe that, and I believe I can speak for both of us when I say that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, action is also important. And in many cases, it's more important than language. And it seems like that this would have been an excellent opportunity for these organizations to announce a redoubling of efforts to fight, for example, the practice of redlining, where certain areas of a city or areas of a, you know, real estate market are, you know, marked out as being, you know, for, you know, where people will sell homes to, you know, Black and other people of color, well, and where they won't.
Realtors have a role in that, but that's primarily a bank issue or a lender issue.
You're absolutely right. And I'm not saying
we can look at, and it's HAR, Houston Area Realtors. HAR is taking an action delayed that they can affect.
Yes, that's true.
You know, there in New York, they used to have something called blockbusters.
Mm.
Have you ever heard that term, Andrew?
Well,
aside from the video.
Aside from the video store? No, I'm afraid not.
Okay. Blockbusting in like the 50s, 60s, 70s was an ambitious, maybe kind of ruthless realtor or however you want to frame it. What they would do is they would find a house for sale in a white neighborhood and show it to people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And when that one of those people bought, you would get the white flight, and all of a sudden you would have this realtor listing a whole lot of properties.
Right.
And you'd get a whole lot of flux.
Right.
And that was called blockbusting, where you would have these white neighborhoods, you would get a person of color, all of a sudden the whites would get scared for whatever reason perceived, and now all of a sudden the realtors are making a lot of money.
Mm.
So there was that aspect of it.
Right.
But then there are the neighborhoods where you have people of color, Black neighborhoods, Hispanic neighborhoods, where you have people that want to stay in their neighborhoods. That's where they grew up. Sometimes they inherit a house. They're doing better than their parents were. I've seen this personally. They decide to improve the house, repair the house, expand the house. But getting a loan to do that is the thing that becomes really hard. And that's what redlining is about.
Right. Okay.
Equally, if somebody wants to buy a house in a neighborhood, it's very hard for the seller in that neighborhood to find someone who can get financing because that's another form of redlining. So sometimes what developers will do is they'll start to buy up properties really at a severe discount because that's the only way that they can be sold where the developer can pay cash, don't have to worry about financing, and then they redevelop it, rezone it, whatever. So that's kind of that whole principle. So realtors can have had a historic role in that.
Yes.
But I think kind of like the auto industry and the petroleum industry, I think that their interests have diverged somewhat in that area.
Sure. But, you know, redlining isn't the only practice, I think, that in financial terms that I think could be addressed in terms of racial justice. I mean, gentrification is something, is a crisis that a lot of, black communities are facing because, you know, they're...
Or end up getting moved further out.
Yeah, and
it's one of those double-edged sword things from a city government kind of point of view.
Right. And, you know, somebody has to sell those homes to those people. You know, somebody has to sell those buildings to those people. So while, sure, no one link in the chain is going to be able to, you know, break the whole thing, it's important that it's important that organizations and individuals recognize what they can do, not just what is easy for them to do.
There's a lot of interactivity in the chain.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's this. Now, the realtor example is a much better example than the Unilever example in that, you know, it's going to have more of an impact because it has it's a response to a push by the black community.
It's a response, which is a plus.
It's a response, which is a plus. And it actually will affect policy. It has some significant change. And so
I will say, as an older person, you know, when you talk terminology changes, it's hard for a generation that's grown accustomed to a term to change the term. But there was a time when the idea of changing spokesman to spokesperson or fireman to firefighter, I mean, those kinds of changes seem pointless and ridiculous, and yet here we are.
Yes.
So, you know, generational change does happen, and unfortunately it's slow, but it is there.
Yes. But it's important to remember, you know, look at what you can do, not just look at what's possible to do, not just what's easy to do. That's my kind of main point here.
I think that's a good point to end on for now. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. Always remember that there's usually a whole lot more to what we're talking about on the website, thinkwingradio.com. There are links to articles so you can see what it is I'm citing. And even what I leave out, there's still so much more on the website, and then there's so much more on the article links. There's just great ways to start research on some of these questions. Also keep in mind that you can write to thinkwingradio@msn.com, or you can tweet to me at thinkwingradio on Twitter, or you can comment on blog posts. And even though we can't take phone calls now because this is being recorded on the 28th at 3:47 a.m. for broadcast on Monday. Anyway, so
this is how we live our life, folks.
This is how we live our lives. We've just kind of gone into this weird 28-hour day cycle. It's tough. The rotation is tough. So anyway, getting back to business. We're kind of now evolving. We're talking about words and terminology and what works, what doesn't, what's fake, what's real. So, like, for me, there was a change in April of 1997 where Houston Intercontinental Airport, without any debate, without any announcement, became George Bush Intercontinental Airport, named for H.W. Bush. That took effect May of 1997. And why did they do this? I think it was because George Bush was living in Houston at the time. It was like, hey, that's a good PR thing. But I have to tell you, you know, just my thing, I still don't call it Bush Intercontinental. I still call it IAH or Intercontinental. I just don't want to call it Bush.
Yeah.
So in terms of me trying to understand other people's point of view, that for me is a point of departure. I was really unhappy that that just was done. There was never any public commentary or anything.
So, that does seem like the kind of thing that they should have solicited comments from the public
on. Yeah, it's more than a tiny thing. It's the name of the airport now for generations.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, because I've never known it as anything else. I've always known it as George Bush Intercontinental Airport. To be honest, I even forgot that there was a / Houston on the end of it. I guess that's why it's...
That's it for me.
Yeah. So, and to be fair, I never call it Bush Intercontinental. I call it Intercontinental or Houston Intercontinental. So yeah.
Well, so you're on my side in this.
I am.
Cool. It helps.
It helps.
So now we get into what we call things and why we call them that. And when I started to do a little research on this for what I was going to bring into the show, I ran across a 3-year-old story that could have been written yesterday. It's from The Guardian. It's called Statues Are Not the Issue. These are history wars, a battle over the past. Subcaption, it can only be a good thing that national stories so long seen as established fact are being challenged both in the U.S. and Britain. This is from August of 2017. The story refers to the Charlottesville protests. The neo-Nazis, neo-Confederates, Ku Klux Klan, rallying around the statue of Robert E. Lee, and someone got killed.
Mm.
So the story goes on that in the U.S. and the U.K., monuments that just a few years ago we might have paid little attention to are now at the center of heated and angry debates. This is 3 years ago. More than 30 U.S. cities are in the process of removing memorials to the Confederacy or have already done so. And then it goes on about Cecil Rhodes, if people have a memory, the Rhodes Scholarship,
him.
So that's kind of why they have a statue, is because he was a philanthropist to like education and scholarship. But he also founded the colony of Rhodesia.
Mm.
So mixed kind of history. And then you had Edward Colston, a statue to Edward Colston, who was a Bristol slave trader, but the statue wasn't put up because he was great in the slave trade. He had done other things in terms of enhancing the community or the port. So again, you get into these mixed histories and mixed messages.
And it was actually a statue of Colston recently that was dumped in the river in Bristol.
That's true. 3 years in the making.
Yeah.
So the great untruth, the story goes on, I'm omitting a lot, the great untruth around which everything pivots is the idea that the defenders of these statues are the defenders of history and truth, while those who want to see them toppled or contextualized are the, quote, Huns at the gate, with a link to what that means, who would destroy national histories and bring down great men. So, again, further down the story, something potentially positive and significant is emerging 3 years ago. Because as the new history wars play out, the defenders of statues to slave traders and imperialists in Britain and Confederate generals in the U.S., these defenders might prove their own worst enemies by choosing to draw their lines and make their stands around the defense of statues that are accidentally allowing histories that might otherwise have remained hidden to be revealed.
Hmm.
So, you know, this starts to get us into what things are called, why they're called that, monuments, why monuments are erected, who they're erected to. Were these people just evil? Did they do good things? Did they do evil and good things? Is there a balancing act here? So this is kind of where we are. This story written 3 years ago, which is why it made a big impression on me. So, Andrew, I'm going to let you chime in before we go on to the next rather lengthy segment.
Yeah, okay. I wish I could remember this better, but there's a point, you know, bouncing around in the back of my mind, and I'm sure wherever I read it, it was said much better than I'm going to repeat it here. But it was something like, you know, the fact that so many people see statues of historical figures and just know that there's a statue there and don't really ever look into it all that much. You know, the fact that people are routinely surprised when they learn that a historical figure that's has a statue in their local park was connected with the Atlantic slave trade or had a, you know, owned a plantation or, you know, founded a colony somewhere. You know, the fact that
or espoused people, racist ideas about superior and inferior civilizations or races, that yes. they were outspoken racialists.
Yes.
And yet they have a statue.
Yes. And the fact that people are surprised at these things suggests that one of the common defenses of them, that they remind people of history, they remind people of the mistakes of the past, it suggests that they're not doing as good of a job of that as some people might think and as some people might wish. And so I think that's enough of an argument to me to kind of poke holes in the argument that these statues, by their very existence, help remind us of the horrors of our history. Because, you know, in my eyes, a statue or a painting or a bust or anything like that is a glorification of that person. You know,
well,
showing...
to borrow a phrase, it's kind of the banality of presence. Mm. You see them all the time. You
yes.
don't think about what they are, who they are, what they represent.
Yes.
You just assume they must have been good because there's a monument or a statue.
Yes, yes. And it's because that is what we that is our cultural you know, understanding. If somebody has a statue, somebody thought they were good, or somebody, you know, what may end up being the reality is somebody thought they were notable enough to have a statue, but mm-hmm. we assume that they were the person who erected the statue or paid for it or designed it thought they were good enough to have a statue, liked them enough to have a statue. So that's, to me, that's what the problem is. The problem is not that these statues, you know, the lack of them would make us forget about our history, because it wouldn't. I mean, there's all sorts of history plaques at famous locations. The Texas Historical Commission does that. And these plaques have their own problems, yes, because they have to be written by people, and mm-hmm. people have prejudices and biases. But at least they do have a story. They have an explanation of what went on there, at least in the eyes of the Texas Historical Commission. That's more than most statues.
But I will say that
statues.
While when I see, like, historical plaque markers,
yes,
there is interesting information if you are actually willing to say, oh, there's a historical plaque a mile down the road. I'm going to slow down. I'm going to pull and I'm going to read. I've actually done that, by the way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're talking about maybe half-inch high font
yeah.
on a brass plaque
yeah.
with poor contrast from a distance.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to see it blown by at even 40 miles an hour.
That's
so
fair.
Unless you stop and read it, you're not going to know what it says, which makes them useful but not extremely useful.
That's true. But I would argue they're still more useful than a statue, because the statue, you get an assumption of what the history was. There's very often no real opportunity at that statue to dive into more of the history, to get the context. And, you know, a plaque to me, at least, because this may be very subjective, has more of a sense of notability rather than of belovedness, if that's a word.
Which actually segues very nicely into the next section, which I will tease and then do an early break. I wrote an email and invited comments on Twitter and Facebook. Basically, I posed a whole bunch of questions to a mixed group of people. And you can go to the blog post and see all the different points I was requesting comments on. But essentially, it comes down to statues and monuments, who erects them and why. And then there's a whole lot of sub-detail to that. But I think that sums it up really well. And what are the long-term ramifications? And is there a time when they should be recontextualized, removed, moved to someplace else? I didn't give people a lot of notice, but I did get a few responses. And we'll go into that in a moment. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson, and I do suggest that you go to kpft.org. We weren't expecting that, were you, Andrew? I do suggest kpft.org is what keeps the station on the air. It's what keeps ThinkWing Radio on the air. It's what keeps all the other programming on KPFT and HD2 on the air.
It's what keeps me from being bored out of my mind during this lockdown.
That's true. You see, as a retired person, I have my internet, I have my DVRs, I have my phone. I'm cool. It's a little tedious, but I'm cool. Mm. However, without KPFT, it would be a lot more tedious and a lot less cool.
Yeah.
So kpft.org, you can click on donate. You can read different information on what's going on with the station. You can also text 713-526-5738. Text the word give, and you'll go through a whole automated thing, and I hope you'll pick ThinkWing Radio as the show you're donating to, but it all goes into the same place, kind of like dinner.
Mm.
Okay, so with this whole list of questions that I asked, some things came to mind. First of all, what I have had to be rethinking, and I mean, I consider myself a reasonably well-informed person. I'm always learning new stuff now because of the access to information we all have if we want to seek it out. So I've learned that history isn't neat. I've said before on the show there are three versions of history, the winner's version, the loser's version, and the truth. And what we're learning is now, or being reminded, the truth is messy. So I got a number of responses to my questions, and I've sort of anonymized them from a liberal white woman. On the question of who built them and why, she said she would love to see some creative and educational art installations, tagging an unfortunate word, tagging some of the statues of Confederate generals, bringing awareness to the history that we were not taught. The revisionist lies we have been told. Now everyone needs to know that statues were built by white people to perpetuate their supremacy over people of color and create the false story about the purpose of the Civil War, which in some places is still called the War Between the States and the War of Northern Aggression.
Hmm.
And then there was another respondent who I would describe as an older right-of-center white male, and he said that public statues are typically a visible artistic way to celebrate a societal achievement or a person's contribution to society. The achievement, the contribution, the person depicted by the statue, or the artistic elements can be reevaluated by later generations, revised, removed, or replaced. Then I have a friend in Australia that I've had an email relationship with for about 25 years. He has sort of a little interesting different spin. Should they be taken down? And his feeling is generally no, unless they actually give the wrong message. So as long as the memorial doesn't mean to say that the slave trade was good or slavery is good, that or the reason it is erected is to be proud of the slave trading, that should not be suppressed. Australia, this is interesting. Australia has a tendency to glorify criminals because it started out as a penal colony. It is quite common for communities to be split about the erection of some monument. He says, and this is interesting because now he's taking it from a perspective literally on the other side of the planet. I don't understand the penchant in the USA to remove statues commemorating the Civil War in the South. There needs to be, this is his opinion now, there needs to be a balanced view of these things so long as the statue shows that the thing that happened, not that it was good, but that it occurred. So long as reference to the North is not incorrectly disparaging, the message of the memorial might need to be modified, not the whole thing removed. And then he goes on, because this is a thing in Australia. Captain Cook seems to be suffering in Australia at the moment. Any statues might be removed. Then the Australians deny themselves knowledge about a person's achievements or happenings.
And for the record, Captain James Cook, was it? Was that his name? Do you remember? Anyway, Captain Cook.
Something like that. James John.
Yeah, Captain Cook was a British. He wasn't a sailor, was he?
He was an explorer. He was a naval commander.
He was
tasked with exploring the South Atlantic and Pacific.
Yes, explorer is how he's commonly referred to. And he was the person who discovered Australia, I believe, and New Zealand, or just
he discovered a lot of the Pacific Islands.
Mm.
He may have discovered Australia. I think that the Dutch originally had New Zealand, hence the name. When the British took it over, they just kept the name.
Right.
But I think he's most remembered for his impact on the Pacific Islanders and his impact on the Maoris. I believe that's how it's pronounced, the Maoris. And obviously the impact that European colonization had on them, which would be like New Zealand and maybe Eastern Australia, as well as the Pacific Islands. So, yeah, he's not a popular guy among a large segment of the human race. So, was he courageous? Yeah, I think he actually died during these voyages. So, I mean, it wasn't an easy thing. Did he bring ill fortune to the peoples he found? Yeah, demonstrably he did. History isn't clean. It's not neat. And I think that's something we all have to start remembering. Humans are human. We build statues, we erect monuments, but that doesn't change the humanity of the people they're being, for some reason, memorialized. Okay, so this is a comment that was on Facebook from someone I follow, and he makes the comment, it's black male, retired. He says, Jefferson Davis, he sums up, was an American politician, served as president of the Confederacy. As a member of the Democratic Party, he represented Mississippi in the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. He also, before the Civil War, obviously, he also served as a U.S. Secretary of War under President Franklin Pierce, 1853 to 1857. And what this gentleman says is he is not a proponent of revisionist history. He does feel contextual history is valid. And if you have the ability to think critically, I kind of like this line. You will understand what I'm talking about. If you don't, then bless your heart. You can visit the statue in a museum after the pandemic. Smiley face American flag. So, I mean, I think this is interesting that you have really a variation of people. And there were other opinions and comments, and I've had to cut this down quite a bit, believe it or not. So I think it's interesting how their opinions vary, but they kind of intersect.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a little bit more. There's people that have been following the news may have heard that there was a statue or is a statue currently outside the American Museum of Natural History in New York to Theodore Roosevelt. And it has an African and a Native American. Teddy Roosevelt is on a horse. And these two men are on either side of him, looking like they're in an inferior Eurocentric position. So there's now been a big debate. The American Museum has decided they're going to remove this statue, place it somewhere else. They haven't decided what to do with it yet. And there's sort of this discussion on the New York Times editorial page. Surely the intent of the statue should be left to the man who sculpted it, the sculptor. In his words, what he intended was that the two figures at Roosevelt's side are guides symbolizing the continents of Africa and America. He goes on to say, and if you choose, may stand for Roosevelt's friendliness to all races. Of course, what's interesting is the next letter I cite is from a guy who wrote a biography called Theodore Roosevelt, A Manly President's Gendered Personal and Political Transformations. And he says that the biography he wrote lauds Roosevelt for his domestic policies, the Food and Drug Administration, workplace safety, environmental preservation, natural resource protection. But the book also condemns him for his racism, mitigated, and I don't know the details of this, interesting, only in the last 2 years before his death. So the statue, in the author's opinion, is an express depiction of Teddy Roosevelt's racism. And then there's another letter, and I've highlighted this one. All people are complex amalgams of different traits. We should not stop reading the Declaration of Independence, the writer says, or rename our capital city because Jefferson or Washington were slave owners. The monuments we should remove are those of figures whose fame and legacy relate primarily to slavery. Different moral values prevail in different times and places. We cannot evaluate historical figures by our current sensibilities. So this kind of goes into a comment I've made, which is that when you review history, I think there is some value to evaluating historical figures in the context of their times. We can decide whether they did right or wrong by our standards in our time, in our culture. But I think that it's always important to see a historical figure in the context of their time. Were they brutal in the context of their time? Were they forward-looking in the context of their time? And humans being humans do bad things. And not everything they do is necessarily bad. And not everything they do is necessarily good. So, and then there's another bit. Citizens of indigenous nations, Onondaga, I believe I'm pronouncing that close, applaud the reckoning with centuries of racism, and know that removing statues of Christopher Columbus is essential for that cleansing to continue. So now, again, we're getting into the question of whose ox is gored. You've got a lot of liberal Americans who say, hey, Confederate statues, bad. Put them in museums. Don't laud them over the public. Don't have Calhoun, can't remember his first name, 70 feet up on a pedestal that every citizen, including people of color, have to pass by that in front of the city hall all the time. Where does it stop? Does it stop? How do we decide? Who assesses? And then this I thought was interesting. It's not the last letter, but it's the last one I cited. That we should not attempt to destroy our history. This person references Hungary in the post-communist era, that they dedicated a park where these memorials, in quotes, can be moved. In 1991, Hungary announced the creation of Memento Park, where the statues of Lenin, Marx, Engels, and many Hungarian communists hold forth. And they date from Hungary's communist rule, 1949 to 1989. And then there's this last quote, and then I'll go on to something else after Andrew has his shot. Thomas Jefferson, this was sent to me by a writer friend. I love this guy. We don't see each other much, but he's a great friend. Thomas Jefferson, in a letter to James Madison, January 1790, the earth belongs, here's a great word, in usufruct, look it up, to the living. The earth belongs to the living, that the dead have neither powers nor rights over it. The portion occupied by any individual ceases to be his when himself ceases to be and reverts to the society. And then in relation to the monuments, my friend writes, I believe these are his words, tear them down, I say, and build new ones and tear those down and build more yet. The earth doesn't belong to those memorialized or those who decided to memorialize them. And then to the question of how much societal consensus should it take to remove or install. He writes, if enough people are angry enough to defy police who are armed like infantrymen, I'd say that's just the right number. A couple of great quotes from my friend the writer.
Yeah, some really
good. I've asked quotes. Him if I can cite his name in the blog post, because I really think if those are his, he should own them.
Mm. Well, so we've read a lot of statements there, and
which is the point.
Which is the point.
To get this mix.
Yes, but it means that I have to scroll up quite a bit in order to remind myself what we've said and
That's
remember what I wanted to comment. Yes. The first response that I want to respond to is, well, the first one from the New York Times letter to the editor, page, which is where all the best conversation happens. That's sarcasm, is surely the intent of the statue should be left to the man who sculpted it. I disagree strongly.
But it's a valid perspective. It's a point of departure for the discussion, I think.
It is a point of departure.
And that, I think, is why the Times put it at the top, near the top.
That's quite possible. But the concept of the death of the author is something that is invoked in analysis of media generally. When we don't, at least I don't really think about statues as media, but I guess they are.
They certainly were before media.
No, that's true.
You know that ancient statues were usually painted, so they looked more lifelike because they didn't have photographs. That's how you recognized who the emperor or the king was.
Huh. That makes sense.
They found traces of paint.
Huh. But getting, you know, back to this particular point, the concept of death of the author, at least in the way that I've encountered it, has often been invoked to defend a piece of media from people who are saying, look, you know, this is this particular scene or this particular joke or this particular character, the way they're represented and written, is racist, sexist, homophobic, transphobic, or prejudiced in some way. And it's and that is a usage of that concept that I disagree with again. But I think what's interesting about the concept is that it can be used to criticize media as well. The thing is, the idea of death of the author says that once an author has completed a work and made it public and released it to people, the author's input no longer matters, or at least it loses most of its power as it, you know, when the thing was being written.
And perception becomes reality at that point.
What's more important is what the messages that people get out of the media are ultimately what matter more than the perception or than the messages, sorry, that the author intended to put into the media. And that is a perspective that I agree with. And I think that what matters more is rather than what the statue meant to the sculptor is what it means to the people, what it means to the people who see it every day, what it means to the people who come to see it only once in their life. You know, trying to defend something by saying the author didn't intend it this way. The author.
Well, it's kind of like pleading guilty with an explanation, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. God, I wish I could.
We're going to move on shortly because we've only got about 8 more minutes left.
Okay. I wish I could read that Hungarian word. I can't. Memento Park.
That's why I didn't try to pronounce it.
Yes, it's a very interesting idea, and I think it is the kind of idea that comes from people who want to sort of compromise in a contentious situation like this undoubtedly was.
And I think it's valid. You know, we don't have a ministry of truth that erases people from pictures and changes newspaper articles to conform to the government's current line. I think that a lot of reasonable people are not saying that we should destroy statues or melt them down, but they belong perhaps in museums that talk about the Civil War, that talk about the Cornerstone speech, and that the South was defending slavery really with no shame at all, that the reconstruction, if you will, of the Confederate legend happened after the war.
Mm.
That well, it's just about states' rights.
It's an understandable kind of compromise instinct or compromise solution, but and honestly, I don't fully know how I feel about it. But I can see arguments against it from both the people who want the statues gone and the people who want the statues preserved. The argument for the people who want the statues gone. Against something like this, against
now,
simple
gone,
relocation.
You're talking destroyed.
I am talking destroyed, yes.
Okay.
The argument... Yes, absolutely. The argument from the people who would want the statues destroyed against moving them to somewhere else is that they're still there. They're still influencing the minds of visitors. Now, if you place them in a different context, if you establish that context at the entry to that venue, maybe you can, you know, mitigate some of the impact of the statues in ways that the people who object to their existence finds harmful. But the fact is that they're still there. They're not getting exactly what they want, but I mean, that's kind of the idea of a compromise. And the argument from people who are in favor of keeping the statues is they're being removed from their places of prominence or from their original context. You know, the history, if you like what the statue represents, who the statue represents, then you're going to be upset that the person's not being, displayed prominently anymore. But if you have just an interest in preserving history as accurately as possible, then there's you're removing the context from that statute particularly, not
okay,
the person.
I'm going to jump in here because we are running a little short on time, but I'm going to draw a radical analogy because sometimes those are the most clarifying. If you go to Germany, you don't see anything glorifying Nazis. Nazi memorabilia is illegal. You cannot trade it. You cannot buy it. You cannot sell it. You cannot display a Nazi flag. You cannot display swastikas. This is an intentional constraint, essentially, on free speech because their history is so frightening that they don't want to do anything to memorialize Hitler. And, of course, what we are finding is you still have memories of Hitler. You still have neo-Nazis. And then you have other people who draw what might be considered the appropriate lessons from learning about Hitler, which is we really have to protect against that kind of thing happening anywhere, anytime. So what is the correct solution? The erasure or the contextualization? The horror, seeing the movies of the horror, taking with that the fact that there are going to be some people that are going to see that as a good thing, but that the majority of people are going to see that as a horrific thing. Whereas if you didn't have any of that history at all, there would be no lessons to be drawn, and history, if it didn't repeat itself, would still rhyme.
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting specific example. There have been criticisms of the sort of denazification of Germany in that it's some people view it as mostly cosmetic, and that political reforms that could have been employed weren't employed, and that it didn't quite go far enough.
Well, I will point out that if you compare
I'm sorry, but
I want to get to Frederick Douglass. I don't want to leave that out.
Yes.
If you remember, the occupation of Germany, the denazification of Germany, went a whole lot better than the deimperialization of Japan. MacArthur took the infrastructure of Japan essentially as it was post-war. So they never really had the need to reconcile their history with how the Asians, like the Chinese and the Koreans and the Filipinos, viewed the Japanese part in the war, the Japanese occupation. Whereas the Germans have totally restructured their society in ways that I think Americans have trouble comprehending. The difference between the Germany that is on the world stage today versus the Germany that was on the world stage 80 years ago. It's an amazing change. I mean, you still have people that don't like the Germans, and I get that. I'm Jewish. I think that they've done a remarkable job of transforming their society. I think they deserve credit, and I think that the Japanese fall short there. But let's get to Frederick Douglass.
Well, I want to say one last thing on this point.
Yes. You're the editor.
In the immediate aftermath of World War II, several members of the West German administration were former
occupation administration.
The occupation administration were former Nazi politicians, Nazi leaders, and so the unfortunate fact is that while some may like to present the denazification of Germany as a total cultural transformation, it wasn't, unfortunately, and ultimately it's very difficult to ever ensure that there is a complete cultural transformation of that type. So that is something to keep in mind, I think.
I think that the comparison that you make has been made, but I think the comparison to make is the one post-Iraq War, where we de-Bathized everything, and then we ended up with chaos. So, you know, you have a situation in Germany where a Nazi fifth column, a Nazi insurgency was a real concern, but it turned out that it was manageable and the occupation went pretty smoothly. And we ended up with a democratic Germany, a post-Nazi Germany. People that grew up under Nazism, you know, they lived out their lives. Some of them managed to hide their past. Others didn't do anything that they wouldn't have done as a patriot to any other country. They served their country, however willingly or unhappily. Whereas in Iraq, we had catastrophe. So which is the better example to learn from? Just moving on, because I want to get to Frederick Douglass. There's an article in the Washington Post that Frederick Douglass delivered a Lincoln reality check at Emancipation Memorial unveiling. On April 14th, 1876, 11 years after Lincoln's assassination, speaking to a crowd of 25,000 people, Douglass made a number of remarks. I hope you'll go to my website, find the link to the story, and read it. It's very long, but very interesting. I think the key part here is Douglass criticized Lincoln as not moving fast enough to free thousands of enslaved black people. That he tarried long in the mountain, Douglass said, when he strangely told us that we were the cause of the war, which Lincoln actually did. It's like, if you guys weren't here, we wouldn't be having this war. When he still more strangely told us that we were to leave the land in which we were born, which is the reason there is a Liberia. Look it up. When he refused to employ our arms, meaning black men, in defense of the Union, and after accepting their services, refused to retaliate for their murder and torture when they were prisoners of the Confederates. When Lincoln said that he would save the Union, I'm paraphrasing a little now, if he could, with slavery. In other words, Lincoln's goal was preserve the Union. If he could preserve the Union as a slave country, he would. If he could preserve it by abolishing slavery, he would. If he could preserve it the way it had been, with slave and non-slave, he would do that. That was his objective. So when he revoked the proclamation, I didn't know this, when he revoked the proclamation of emancipation of General Fremont, apparently this was something that the general did in an area that he had conquered of the Confederacy. When Lincoln refused to remove the popular commander of the Army of the Potomac in the days of its inaction and defeat, can't remember the name of the general, I used to know that just a moment ago. When we, as black people in America, saw all this and more, we were at times grieved, stunned, greatly bewildered, but our hearts believed while they ached and bled. Douglass went on further to say, it was enough for us that Lincoln was the head of a great movement and was in living and earnest sympathy with that movement, which, in the nature of things, must go on until slavery should be utterly and forever abolished in the United States. There's a whole lot more to this speech. I mean, my excerpts don't begin to do it justice, but I think it's really important to read this story and to learn about it. Okay, sorry, Andrew, but you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. My co-host and editor of this is Andrew Ferguson. I appreciate his work, and I appreciate his participation and co-hosting this, if that's a word. We will be back next week. Hopefully we'll run better on time. Everyone have a great week, and hope that this was informational. Take care.
See you later, folks. It's not too late.
Never been a better time to donate your car to KPFT. When you contact the KPFT car donation hotline, you will do something great for this community. Call 1-855-573-8227 to donate or find out more information. KPFT is the only radio station of its kind located in Texas. It broadcasts music, news, information, and cultural programming from national distributors, as well as locally produced offerings and more. Your donated vehicle goes to support this unique voice for yourself and others. Have an old car taking up space in your driveway? Donate it to KPFT now. Just call 1-855-KPFT-CAR or visit kpft.org to donate your old vehicle to support KPFT. Your contribution is appreciated. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
C Since 1970, KPFT has been driven by people giving their free time to answer phones, sweep floors, run soundboards, and much more.
Unlike commercial radio, passion, not advertising dollars, fuels the radio you hear.
Do you have a few minutes to lend a hand?
Volunteers come from virtually every walk of life and support our operations at any hour of the day or night.
Call 713-526-4000 to learn more about volunteering at KPFT.